Chapter 5. And I don't want the world to see me, 'cause I don't think that they'd understand. When everything's made to be broken, I just want you to know who I am. Jaster, Arla says, and rises to her feet. She's in full armor, the way she almost always is, but her helmet is off, and Jaster smiles at the sight, taking the hands she offers him and leaning in to rest their foreheads together. Arla, he returns, having fun. Arla's grin has teeth. We've found out what colors don't suit your Jedi, but I think we're getting there. Jaster gives her a faintly narrow look, but lets that stand. Arla isn't a cruel person, and she wouldn't be needlessly mean to someone left in her care, even if that person is a Jedi. Have you found something, then? I think so, Zarin says from behind one of the screens at the far end of the room. Jaster glances over just in time to see a length of dark blue cloth get tossed over the top of it. It won't be blaster-proof, because I don't have any resistant fabrics in the right color, but I can at least use one that's hard to cut through. I'm sure that will be fine, Jaster says. I've been told that Jedi are decent at deflecting blaster bolts. Zarin laughs, and a moment later she slides around the edge of the screen, Leku draped around her neck. Supposedly, she says, though there's no barb behind it. She sorts through several rolls of fabric on the table, coming up with one in dark green, and runs her fingers over it for a moment, then hums. All right, I think you're finished. You can take those with you, and I'll start on another set for day use, and then the formal robes. You're sure you don't want... Just robes are fine, John says quietly, and steps out from behind the screen. Jaster sweeps a look over him, impressed with Zarin's skill the way he usually is. She picked a deep blue for the tunics, shaped almost precisely like the Jedi tunics Jaster is used to, but the cloak on top is a deep, rich brown, darker than most Jedi robes to the point that it's nearly black. The cut of them is impeccable as well, draping beautifully but not baggy. The colors make him look healthier, not washed out, and the fall of the cloth emphasizes the breadth of his shoulders and his height, makes it harder to see that he slouches a little like he's hiding his full stature. Zarin makes a thoughtful sound, circling him. Is that hood too deep? She asks with a touch of concern, and reaches out. Jaster catches the faint flinch as her hand nears John's face, but John freezes immediately after, and Zarin is too caught up in tugging and adjusting the hood to notice. It's rare that she pays attention to much beyond cloth anyways. Perhaps a little deeper in the next set even, she says after a moment, stepping back and considering the cloak. What do you think? John pauses, like he's not sure she's addressing him, and then carefully reaches up, adjusting it. Deeper, if that's all right, he says quietly. Of course. Zarin leans over her table, making a note on a scrap of flimsy. I'm used to hoods that go over helmets, so I was overcorrecting for size, but I think a little more drape will help smooth things out. She glances up, then gives Jaster a smile. You brought me a challenge, Mandalore. I like it. John's eyes flicker to Jaster, not like he was unaware of him, but cautious. Jaster doesn't move, just lets Arla lean against him and says, If anyone can handle wedding garb in a week, it's you, Zarin. Zarin's red skin flushes from scarlet to crimson, and she laughs. Flattery won't save you from a fitting, she warns, but her smile is pleased as she circles John once more. If you were hoping for a glimpse of the wedding robes, you're too late. They're our secret now. Only for a few days, Jaster says, unperturbed. He has faith in Zarin, even if her usual bulwark is blaster-resistant undersuits and creating the heavy cloth used in traditional armor. He steps forward, and John turns to meet him, carefully folding the hood back. Clean, his hair curls a little at the ends, feathery and soft as it falls around his face, and Jaster reaches out, clear and deliberate. When John sees the touch coming, he doesn't flinch, just goes still, and Jaster smooths a few dark strands out of his face and hums. A braid for the wedding, perhaps, he says, to keep your hair out of your eyes. John swallows, but he holds still as Jaster tucks his hair back behind his ear, and when Jaster's fingers graze his cheek, He shivers just faintly. Jester finds that he likes it more than he probably should, how easily John responds to a touch. "If you want," he says, soft, and Jester likes that too, that he's so soft-spoken even with his size, his scars. He hadn't realized how much he liked either thing before John. "Jaster's good at hair," Arla says, lazy but focused, and Jester can feel the weight of her gaze on his back. "He's been braiding my hair since he adopted me." John's eyes flicker past Jester, to Arla, then back. He doesn't say anything, and Jester can't quite read the look on his face, but he lowers his hand regardless. "Yes, well, you looked like something I dragged out of a swamp when I first found you, and you wouldn't let anyone close to you with scissors. I was desperate." Arla snorts, clearly unrepentant for all the heart attacks she inflicted on Jester in childhood. "You're the one who thought I was Mando material the moment I tried to stab you," she says, only a little sharp around the edges, but rueful. "That's progress, likely." "I have good taste," Jester tells her, though he can't quite take his eyes off the scarred planes of John's face, the way his lashes dip as he tugs the cloak a little more tightly around his shoulders. "He's striking." "John, I have several reports on Death Watch's activity that might be helpful in piecing together their suppliers, if you would like to look them over." Something like relief crosses John's face, and he nods without hesitation. "I have two more names for you as well," he says. "Potential contacts between the gangs and the Death Watch." Deliberately, Jester offers John his arm, and when John freezes, flicking him a glance, he smiles. "I believe the table in my quarters should be plenty large enough for our needs, and I can have a light meal brought, and tea if you enjoy it." John pauses for a long, long moment, like he's not sure what to do. Jester almost expects him to pull away, but he holds still, waiting John out. And finally, carefully, a long-fingered hand curls around his arm, hanging on with a grip that's a little awkward, like he's trying not to hold too tight. "I do," John says quietly. "I thank you." Jester folds a hand over John's, pressing his thumb against scarred knuckles. Reassurance, maybe, though it's a small gesture in the scheme of things. "You're quite welcome," he says. When he turns to steer them towards the door, Arla is watching him closely, something surprised in the arch of her eyebrows, amused in the curl of her mouth. At Jaster's look, though, she just shakes her head and raises her hands and says, "Have fun," with a dry, sardonic edge. "Your brother keeps trying to escape the medical wing," Jester tells her, and feels no remorse when her expression immediately twists into an elder sister's indignant fury. Django deserves it, and it's a thorough distraction from Arla picking over Jaster's actions. He'll take it. "Excuse me," Arla bites out, shoving to her feet and jamming her helmet on. She storms past Jester and out of the room, a hurricane heading right for Django's bedside, and Jester feels a wash of amused satisfaction as he watches her disappear. That should keep them both out of trouble for at least a few hours. With a chuckle, Zarin crouches down, gathering a stack of folded cloth and wrapping it neatly in what looks like another cloak, this one in a deep green. "Here, Jedi," she says, rising and offering them up. "Another set of robes in different colors. I should have more for you by the end of the week, if my assistant ever finds his way back from all the clubs on Nar Shadda." John falters. More, he says, caught off guard. "You needn't, I can repair my old robes. This is already..." Zarin's brows wing up towards her head wrap, but she shakes her head and pushes the clothes at John insistently. "Not on my watch, Jedi," she says firmly. "It's fine if your order doesn't mind you in rags on missions, but if you're marrying my Mandalore, I'll dress you well. There are standards." Jester can feel John's tension, can see the way he's about to open his mouth, and he curls his hand a little tighter over John's, takes a half step forward before he can speak, and inclines his head to Zarin. "Standards no one could meet more ably. Thank you, Zarin." Deftly, he takes the second set of robes from her and says, "Will you need to see me?" Zarin's frown eases and she smiles. "At your earliest convenience, Mandalore. Your armor's been in need of an update for a while now, regardless, and this is a good excuse." Jaster doesn't grimace, because she's right, but the idea of being without his armor, even for a few days, feels a little like being stranded naked in the middle of the wilderness. I'll have it brought tonight. Thank you. She inclines her head. I'll work quickly, you have my word. That much I never doubted, Jaster says, and shuffles his data pads and the robes for a moment, gets them tucked under his arm, and then steers John toward the door that Arla left ajar. John is moving a little gingerly, careful with his steps in a way that means he's most certainly in pain, and Jaster casts a look over him, then gently pulls away enough to reach his comm. The robes look quite striking on you, he says, most of his attention on a message to the kitchens. I'll admit to some confusion over the Jedi Order's dress code, but I hope these colors don't fall too far outside of it. They flatter you. John falters, just enough for Jaster to notice. His head snaps towards Jaster, then he immediately ducks, hair falling forward to hide his face. It's not quite quick enough for Jaster to miss the wash of red across tanned skin, though, high up across the tops of his cheeks and the bridge of his nose. There's no dress code, John says, but it's rough, even rougher than normal. When Jaster sends the message and reaches out to take his arm again, he startles, seeming spooked, and Jaster pauses. When John doesn't actively recoil from him, though, he takes a step forward, and when John stays where he is, Jaster slides a hand across his shoulder, a steady pressure, drags it down the too obvious line of John's spine through the soft cloth, making his touch as obvious as he can, and then curls a hand over John's hip, taking some of his weight. None, that's good to hear, he says softly, and John's head ducks as a helpless shiver runs through him. It's intriguing in a way that it likely shouldn't be, and Jaster pauses. Wishes his other arm wasn't full, because if he brushed John's hair back, he could see that expression, and he wants to. Taking a breath, he contains himself. This marriage is political in nature, and they're both well aware of it. Gestures that would be more at home between two people courting aren't appropriate. That doesn't change the fact that Jaster's fingers itch to touch. Our meal should arrive before we do, he says, and helps John forward, trying not to be too aware of lean muscle beneath his arm, the way John's hip fits so neatly in the curve of his hand. I told them to leave it in the garden if you're feeling well enough for some fresh air. Please, John says, hoarse, and he's still not looking at Jaster, has his face tipped away. From one offhand, barely there compliment, Jaster thinks, and then sets it aside and files the whole matter away for later. Tell me, John, he says, and makes it as casual as possible. Have you spent much time in the Jedi Archives? That, at least, makes John lift his head, something like surprise crossing his face. The Archives, he asks. Yes, my master is... She uncovers rare books for the Order, sometimes, and I was tasked with bringing them back to Coruscant. That's not anything close to what Jaster was expecting him to say, but it's also intriguing. Rare books, he asks, steering John around a corner. I didn't think that Jedi went looking for such things. He certainly hadn't thought they would appreciate them, the way that harpy of a Jedi guards her archives. John slants him a look that's something close to bemused. Madame New, head of the archives. She spent most of her time as a knight and master looking for old manuscripts, he says. She and my master were creshmates, and since my master isn't often in the temple, she keeps looking for Madame New. At some point, Jaster will be interested in all of the various intricacies of Jedi lineages and the politics involved. But for right now, he's entirely sidetracked by the knowledge that he's managed to accidentally stumble over someone directly connected to the witch. I was unaware that the Jedi had such a tradition. I assumed most of the books were relating to the Order specifically. Some are, John says, and there's the faintest pull to one corner of his mouth, as if something about this conversation is amusing him. But the Order is safe, so some worlds pass on sacred texts or histories for safekeeping. And other worlds have force traditions that the Order tries to preserve. The overarching histories of the Order and its part of the fabric of the Republic was reason enough to want access to their archives. Knowing that there's more makes Jaster's fingers itch desperately. if he could find records of the Mandalorian involvement in things from periods where Mandalore's own history is spotty. It would be biased, of course, but the Jedi haven't faced nearly the schisms the Mandalorians have, and the odds that more of their records are intact are high. And beyond that, the archives are vast. Jaster had been interested in Jedi policy and training and overall knowledge, because no matter how stiff and boring they can be, the Jedi are second only to the Mandalorians in terms of martial prowess. But there's more. There are records from likely hundreds of worlds, traditions and cultures the Jedi have respected and preserved, texts that have nothing to do with the Order, but which have been maintained and kept safe across the ages. Silently, despite all of his words to Miles, Jaster slides getting access to the archives higher up on his priority list. Once they sign the papers, the Harpy will have to let him in. "Well," Jaster says, and drags his mind back to slightly more immediate matters. "I hope if you happen to take after your master, and if you find anything in your travels that would appeal, you'll think of me fondly." John ducks his head again, but this time Jaster catches the way his expression lightens, how his mouth curves in the half second before his hair hides his face again. "Madam Nu has never found a book she's not interested in," he says, and Jaster wants to protest, wants to be indignant. "I hope," he says with great gravity, raising a brow at the Jedi on his arm, "that you aren't laughing at me, Knight Antilles." John shakes his head, but he doesn't raise it, and he doesn't speak, which makes Jaster rather doubtful as to the truth of his words. "I'll look," John says softly, but this time it really is soft, gentle around the edges in a way that catches Jaster's attention. "And split what I find down the middle, between you and the Order." "No splitting the books," Jaster says, a trace of horror surfacing. It's mostly fueled by memories of Jango returning from a job with an ancient printing of a rare book simply shoved in his pack like a spare ration, with a fresh calf stain on the corner of the cover. Jaster isn't a weak man, but that was almost enough to move him to despair. Thankfully, the look John shoots him is equal parts bewildered and taken aback. "I wouldn't," he says, and Jaster breathes out in deep relief. "I was simply making sure," he says, and steers John to a set of wide glass doors overlooking the fields in the distance. Without Jaster having to ask, John reaches for the latch, pushing the closest one open, and Jaster helps him through it, then pauses as it falls shut behind them. Ahead, the stone terrace gives way to stairs, and he eyes them, then casts a glance at John, who's already very clearly strained himself. "I believe this calls for an adjustment," he says, and loosens his grip on John. The fact that John's knees almost buckle as he steps away is a sign that Jaster is right to worry, and he frowns, shifting the robes and the pads. "Given the rate of your healing and the wounds, the fact that you're still this unsteady..." But John shakes his head before Jaster can finish. "I was healing myself," he says, "afterwards. But it was too much, like running 20 kilometers when you already have a gut wound." Jaster weighs that explanation. "The use of the Force translates directly to physical exertion," he asks, a little surprised. He thought it was, well, mental, and therefore able to give one a headache, but nothing beyond that. John nods, and when Jaster offers him the pads and clothes, he glances at them, but takes them without protest or even comment. "Jedi are the Force made physical," he says, like it's a struggle to put it into words. "How it manifests, but we have to channel it through a physical form, and that takes effort." It makes about as much sense as anything regarding the Force ever does, and Jaster files his questions away as something to press John on later, when he's steadier, and steps forward. "Armor on my neck," he says, and John's eyes widen. "I can," he starts, taking a half step back. Deftly, Jaster catches his arm before he can get too far. "John," he says, "this has been more than enough exertion already, and I'm asking you to remain upright and focused while we go over the data as well. Allow me to make it slightly easier on you in this way at least." John swallows, eyes flickering from Jaster to the stairs and back, but after a long second he nods once. Jester gives him a crooked smile, but takes another step to close the gap between them and leans down, wrapping an arm around John's upper back and then sliding the other behind his knees. There's a pause, but after a moment, John's arm curls around the back of his neck, and Jester shifts his weight, rocks back on his heels, and then lifts him as carefully as he can. It still gets him a gasp, one sharp inhale that's all pain, but Jester stays still for a long moment, letting John adjust, and finally the grip on him eases. With a ragged breath, John buries his face in Jaster's shoulder, clearly hiding, and Jester lets him. Minding his steps, he starts forward and, well, carrying John is quite a bit easier out of full armor. The stairs are a little treacherous to navigate, but hardly enough so to make him stop, and he gets them down without incident, then heads along the path of paving stones toward the area that his rooms overlook. Given your master's apparent penchant for book hunting, I assume you were forced to read at least a few, he says, a deliberate attempt to distract, and it seems to work. There's a pause, a breath, and then a nod, still pressed to Jaster's shoulder. She studied old traditions, John manages, and I learned them too. We spent a year in a lost temple once, in the unknown regions. She thought it might have been the first. Jaster raises a brow. The Jedi Temple didn't start on Coruscant, he asks. Given its age and its ties to the Republic, I would have expected the one on Coruscant to be the original. John shakes his head, not looking up even as Jaster spots the small table beneath a leaning tree, the two covered trays and a large pot of tea that's been set out. One of the chairs is cushioned, and Jaster heads for it. There are older ones, John says. Typhon and Ahch-To. No one knows which came first. There are similar debates about the origins of the Mandalorian clans, but Jaster hadn't realized the Jedi Order would have the same sort of uncertainty attached. He crouches down, carefully easing John into the chair, and at the strangled hitch of a breath, he winces, straightens, smooths a hand over John's hair as John curls forward a little, protecting the wound, and stays there until John's breath evens out again. And your master assumes the one in the unknown regions is the first. On what grounds? He asks, equally to distract and because he wants to know. It takes John a moment to gather himself, but finally he raises his head and says, the age of another temple in the Outer Rim. It's some Jedi dispute it, but my master thinks it was the second, that the order spread inward towards the core. That the first Jedi were from the unknown regions, but were explorers who stumbled on the Republic. It's certainly not a theory that Jaster has heard before, though the Jedi have always rather been shrouded in mystery and legend and pure bantha dung in the form of spacer's tales. He hums thoughtfully, tapping his fingers against the tabletop as he takes the other seat, and then leans forward to uncover the teapot. And you, do you agree with her? John blinks at him, clearly startled to be asked, but pauses as he considers, drawing his cloak a little more tightly around himself and tucking his hands into the sleeves. He seems most comfortable with as much skin covered as possible, and given his reaction when he thought Jaster was mentioning his scars, it makes sense. He starts, and then pauses, weighs something for a moment, and then says quietly, there's a skill, a force ability that's rare. They mention it on Ahch-To, but the next mention of it is on Rusan, near the Valley of Souls. There's an old tomb with texts that show the same thing, and smugglers have stories about one of Rusan's moons, and an old civilization there that has nothing left to it but ruins. It is, Jaster thinks with some surprise, carefully reasoned and thoughtful, attentive to details. Not what he would have expected from a Jedi wandering around with holes in his boots. Sometimes skills arise independently, he points out, more to see what John's response will be than because he truly wants to argue. John nods. They do, he allows, but it changed as the Order did, and methods in the texts on Rusan are identical to the ones on Ahch-To. Either the text traveled later, or the skill did, and I don't know which. Jaster hums, pouring cups for them both. He passes John's over, watching surreptitiously as John wraps long fingers around the mug and holds it close, and makes a mental note to ask Zarin to be sure John has a heavy winter cloak when he leaves her his armor this evening. She'll likely think of it herself, but he wants to be sure. It's certainly an interesting argument. I would like to know more if you have any books on the matter. I know some, John says, and there's something carefully pleased to the slant of his mouth in the moment before he hides it behind the cup, takes a sip, and then pauses. Jester watches his face, the flicker of surprise and then pleasure, and smiles to himself. A fan of tea, then, and able to tell a good one when he tastes it. Clearing his throat, Jester busies himself with removing the covers from their trays, then settling John's in front of him. "Eat," he says, "and tell me what makes you think there was a Jedi settlement on the Rusan moon. I'll admit I've heard rumors of such a thing, but I've never gone there." For a long moment, there's no response. When Jester glances up, John is watching him, something Jester can't read on his face. Before Jester can ask, though, John ducks his head, brushing his hair back behind his ears, and nods. "I thank you," he says, a little rough, "for the food and the tea." "Of course," Jester says, a little confused as to why this needs thanks. Pauses and belatedly says, "It may be too hot for your tastes," just as John takes his first bite. John snorts softly, though it's amusement rather than offense, and like this, sitting across from him, Jester can see the slant of that amusement clearly for the first time. It warms John's features, brightens his eyes, and for a moment, Jester can't quite look away. "It's good," John says, looking up, and the swift, almost furtive glance from those pale eyes holds Jaster's attention in a way nothing has in a very long while. "Finish the plate and tell me that again," Jester says after a moment too long, and picks up his own fork. Shakes himself, breathes in, and focuses. "You've been to Rusan, then?" Easier, really, to consider the almost mythical history of the Jedi Order than anything else right now. Jester can dwell on other things later, and overthink his own reactions then. For now, a pleasant conversation seems far more enjoyable than self-reflection. End of chapter 5.